Well, good afternoon to you, and thank you very much indeed for your welcome. It's great to be here back at All Souls, and thank you for coming today. It's great to see so many people here in the middle of a busy day. When I chose the title Life Without Spin, I wasn't quite aware, I didn't really look at the dates, of what would be going on with the party conferences at this time of the year, and it seems to me that it is probably quite an appropriate title, given what's happened this week and the week before and what will doubtless happen next week. But whether or not you believe that the Prime Minister did apologise, or whether you think that you can believe anything that a politician says, it is certainly true that we live in a culture that is very cynical about spin and about truth. Of course, spin has a long history. It began in the Garden of Eden, when Adam and Eve were met by God and asked to give an account of what they've been doing. You remember that the account was in terms of spin. Adam said, it was the woman that you gave me who tempted me, and Eve said, no, it was the serpent who tempted me. And nobody was really willing to accept responsibility. Spin has a long history. And of course, we're all adept at it when it comes to putting ourselves in the best light. So the lies we tell are always white lies. And the things we borrow from the office are always the perks of the job. And people talk about having a fling and having an affair. And there's that wonderful spin phrase, being economical with the truth. We grow used to it. Spin is part of our culture. And people say, well, you can't trust anybody nowadays. That's just the way it is. Of course, that's nothing new in human life. When I was getting married many years ago now, we were looking for a house out in West London. And I was very drawn to one of the estate agent's descriptions of a particular house that said that it included a, quote, shrub-flanked drive. That sounded very nice for our price bracket. And when we arrived, we discovered that there was a carport in front of the house where you could just drive your car in. And on either side, there were two tubs, one tub each side with one shrub in the tub. And I learnt fairly early on that spin has a long history. So the small print in the contract, the politician's promise, does it really matter? Now, I want to suggest to you that it does for this reason. Spin becomes a problem because ultimately it destroys trust, and trust is the glue of human relationships, and relationships are what we all know ultimately make life most worthwhile. So we are actually, from our spin culture, under threat of disintegrating relationships. You see it in the family, you see it in the office, you see it in friendships, even business relationships where you can't really be sure that anybody's telling you the truth. And ultimately, the whole structure of the culture starts to decline. G.K. Chesterton said, when a man really starts to tell the truth, the first truth he tells is that he himself is a liar. And I think he got there before us. I think that's where we are, really. And if you look at your own record, as I look at mine, I can certainly identify with that. Now, as a Christian, it is a huge relief to turn from my own ability to spin things and put myself in the best light possible and the culture of which we're a part to the Bible, and to see that the Bible is a book that is not interested in spin at all. The Bible is a very disarming and straightforward sort of book. It's a great relief to turn to it, and it's for me a great relief to be trying to explain it and teach it to other people, because I don't have to have anything up my sleeve. There's nothing I'm trying to conceal. There's no small print that I'm going to foist on you later on. The Bible is absolutely straightforward about God and about us and about the relationship between us in God's world. And what the Bible actually says is that ultimate truth exists, and that it can be seen and experienced in a person who is called Jesus Christ. So I want to talk to you just for a few minutes about how Jesus makes a difference to spinners, and how the life without spin is a life which is related to Jesus Christ as God's truth about himself and about us. Now, in doing that, I recognize that we need first of all to say that we're talking about a real person. Jesus Christ exists in history with as much evidence for his existence as any other figure from the first century. it was Jean-Jacques Rousseau who said that if Jesus Christ didn't exist, then the mind that made him up must have been just as great as his mind was. And whose mind was it? No, nobody made up Jesus. The existence of a great moral reform like Christianity depends upon a great reformer, and all the authorities would recognize that Jesus was a real person. And we have the four Gospels of the New Testament that give us accounts of his life and his death, and which put before us the claims that he made. So as we talk about Jesus, I don't know what you think about him, but certainly he's there in history. Doesn't mean that he was what he claimed to be, but it means that he's a figure of reality, and we don't have to spin that. He's actually there, unique, I would claim, in the whole history of the world. But I want to show you just three things simply, which I think help us to understand why Jesus is so important, and why actually your relationship to Jesus Christ is the most important thing in your life. Firstly, there's no spin on his claims. If you've got the white sheet in front of you with a passage on it, you'll find that he asked his disciples, "Who do the crowd say I am?" The issue is, who is Jesus? That's still the issue, isn't it? I wonder who you think he is. And they come up with all sorts of suggestions, some pretty bizarre ones, really. Some say John the Baptist, who'd been beheaded by King Herod a few months earlier. Others say Elijah, who'd lived 8 centuries or more before. And others that one of the prophets of long ago has come back to life. Now, why do they say that? Because they can't find a category that actually suits Jesus. They can't place him. They can't work out who he is. But his claims are very, very clear. There is the uniqueness of his teaching, for example, in which he says that he actually is speaking words of God. He's come from God. He is God in human form, revealing himself to human beings, telling us what God is like, telling us how we can live in relationship with him. Now that is totally unique. There are people who claim to speak on behalf of God, but to be God actually speaking marks Jesus out as very different from normal religious teachers. The claims are backed up by the miraculous actions that he performed, the supernatural power of Jesus. And although we're very skeptical about things like that in the 21st century, it is interesting that in the first century, the opponents of Jesus, who would love to have eradicated him from memory, could never deny that he'd done the miracles. They had to say that he'd done them by magic powers, or that he'd done them because he was in league with the devil. But they could never deny that the miracles happened. Nobody did until the 18th or 19th century decided that it couldn't be believed. Those miracles were obviously part of what convinced people that this was God on earth. And there was also his amazing character, because he actually lived what he taught. And nobody could really find fault with him. They had to trump up charges against him in order for him to be arrested and eventually executed. So who is this Jesus who can raise the dead, who can still the storm, who can teach in such a way that nobody's improved on it in 2,000 years? Well, he's a Jesus who also says that he is able to forgive you your sins, that he is the judge before whom you will ultimately stand after your life in this world and give an account of what you've done with the life he gave you, and the one who is the true God, revealing himself to us in human terms that we can all understand, a real human life lived in the real human world. Now, what I want to say to you about that is, it is unique. You can't just look at Jesus of Nazareth and say, if you really take his claims at all seriously, or read the Gospels and think about them, you can't just say, oh, it's sort of faintly interesting. Yes, well, I might examine it sometime. It isn't faintly interesting. It's either the most remarkable thing that you've ever heard, or it's a pack of lies. And what we have to do is to work out what we really think about Jesus. Who do you say he is? He's not just there as a fine religious teacher or a great moral example or somebody who inspires us to be better than we were yesterday. He's claiming to be God. Either he is or he isn't. So you see, there is a division that happens as soon as you start to look at Jesus. And this is where the spin ends. He is actually making very deliberate claims about himself, which, if they're true, mean that there is a God, and that we can know what he's like, and that Jesus is the way that we can come into relationship with him. So there's no spin on his claims. But secondly, there's no spin on his diagnosis. And here the issue is, why did he come? If this really is, as Peter says in verse 20, the Christ of God, that is God's King who has come into the world as the rescuer and the ruler of the whole human race, if that's really true, that Jesus of Nazareth is the Christ, God in human form, then why did he come? What's it all about? Is it just a masterclass in how to be human, or just a wonderful experience of what God might be like? No, look at verse 22. He said, the Son of Man must suffer many things. Son of Man is a title he used about himself. He must be rejected by the religious leaders, the elders, the chief priests, the teachers of the law. He must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. Now, obviously, not every passage of the Bible tells us everything, and so you might well say, well, why must he be killed? Look at the must. He must be killed. Just because there are people against him? No, because this is why he came into the world. That the heart of the message, without spin, is that Jesus came into the world to die on the cross. So that people like us, who've spun our lives away from him by all sorts of rebellion and deceit, can be brought back into a right relationship with God because of what Jesus Christ has done for us on that cross. And so the death of Jesus and the resurrection, for on the third day he was raised to life, which proves that he is God and that death couldn't finish him. He died in order to deal with the problem of our alienation from God, but he rose again from the dead to prove that the divine, eternal life of God is in him. He came to do that so that we could be linked into God, so that we could know God for ourselves, so that the cloud between us and God, the barrier, the separation that we all feel because of our rebellion, could be dealt with once for all, and we could know that we're forgiven, and we could know that we're accepted by God. Do you remember that old hymn we used to sing very often at school? He died that we might be forgiven. He died to make us good, that we might go at last to heaven, saved by his precious blood. Not that we might go to heaven because we're good enough. You see, if heaven was for people who are good enough, there'll be nobody there. Heaven is not for good people. Nobody's good enough for God. Heaven is for forgiven people who know that Jesus stood in the gap between us and his heavenly Father, the God who sent him as his Son into the world, so that we might be forgiven and rightly related to him. So there's no spin on his claims. Who is he? The Christ of God. And when Peter gets that right, Jesus accepts it, and he builds everything from that moment on that being the truth. There's no spin on why he's come, the issue of the diagnosis. We need forgiveness, and it could only happen by God bearing the punishment for us in the person of Jesus dying on the cross. But there's no spin, lastly, on his challenge. Because this is the so what issue. If these things are true, and I realize that in 10 minutes all I can do is sketch in a brief outline, but if they really are true, so what would the difference be? What difference would it make to your life? And here I want to take you to the last part of our passage on the sheet, sentence 25. What good is it, says Jesus, for a man to gain the whole world and yet lose or forfeit his very self? Here's the so what, you see. How we relate to Jesus determines ultimately how God relates to us. And it would be possible, I suppose, for us to work at gaining the whole world, whatever that is to you. We've all got a world we want to gain. We've all got ambitions, things we want, situations we'd like to be in, the way in which we see ourselves if we could write the ideal scenario in 5, 10 years' time. Now, supposing you got everything. Just suppose it worked out like that. And you had it all, the whole world. And yet, in the end, you lost yourself. You forfeited your very being, your personality, who you are. You were alienated and cut off from God, so you never really discovered what it was to be a human being. Well, we all function as human beings, but the ultimate purpose is that we might know God, love him, serve him, experience him, live with him, not only in this world, but forever. Now, supposing you actually turn your back on that and say, okay, I'm not interested in that stuff. That's not part of my world. And you wake up with the world that you've got, and you discover that, well, it doesn't really satisfy you because there's always more you want, and that ultimately at the end you leave it all behind. And what was the purpose of it all? So he does challenge us, doesn't he? He says, everything depends on your relationship to him. If anyone is ashamed of me, sentence 26, and my words, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his glory. That's an extraordinary claim, isn't it? That he's going to be the one who ends history and comes back as King and Lord of all. And what he says is that everything will depend upon our relationship to Christ. So as I finish, you see, the issue today is there some way I can persuade you to accept God? That isn't the issue at all. The issue really is there any way God could be persuaded to accept us? I include myself in that. All of us as human beings need to be acceptable to God. And by nature, we aren't. But the great good news of the Christian faith is that without any spin, just straightforwardly challenging us, diagnosing our need, and claiming that he's the answer, Jesus Christ came in human history all those years ago and still comes wherever people all across the world open their lives and hearts to him and experience his forgiveness, his love, his peace, and his power in their lives. So I want to encourage you as you go away and think about today to take it further. There are ways in which you can do that. Jago is going to explain particular ways in which you can do it. One really good way would be to take this little booklet, which is around as you go, called Two Ways to Live, which explains in more detail than I can in these few minutes what it's all about and takes you through various steps by which you can respond to God for yourself. It'd be a great idea to take that, have time to read it, think it through, and then there are other ways too in which you can relate to what I've said. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you for listening. And I hope that we'll see you again on another occasion like this. Thank you.